From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The COVID-19 pandemic shut down many North Carolina businesses. Even those allowed to remain open had to scramble. They had to adjust to major disruptions in their markets. You'll hear how one business owner was forced to innovate. During a recent hearing on Capitol Hill, one North Carolina congressman asked important questions about the search for a COVID-19 vaccine. You'll hear them. Even before the pandemic, North Carolina's state government pension plan needed changes. You'll learn why. And we'll tackle some health care policy reforms North Carolina policymakers ought to address. Those reforms are part of the John Locke Foundation's new Carolina Rebound program. Speaking of Carolina Rebound, Donna Martinez tackles that topic in the Carolina Journal headline.
COVID-19 has affected government budgets at all levels. The federal government, for example, has taken on massive amounts of debt with its relief packages. State government here in North Carolina is facing incredible pressures due to lost revenues, things like income tax, sales tax, gas tax, you name it, not coming in as expected. So as we look to the recovery mode in our state, there are sound principles and tactics that will help guide our path forward. And they are laid out in Carolina Rebound. That is the John Locke Foundation's game plan to revive North Carolina's economy, available at johnlocke.org. Joe Coletti is senior fellow with the Locke Foundation, one of the authors of this new report. He joins us now. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Always glad to be here.
Give us some context about how COVID-19 has impacted North Carolina in terms of the fiscal and tax area.
Yeah. Well, the clearest place that it's had an impact because of the response to it, both personal and government responses, to basically shut down the economy. And so, as you would expect, sales tax revenues fell off greatly in April. They started to fall off in March once things started to slow down. And we're not sure when that's going to revive. And as businesses closed down, the income tax also fell off because people don't have jobs. So those two were the biggest impact on the general fund. And the sales tax also affected cities and counties. And then we've seen more in the headlines has been the effect on transportation, on the transportation department, which is already in financial problems. But because there's not business and because people have been told to stay home and have chosen to stay home, the gas tax has also fallen greatly. And so those are the three main areas that we've seen on the revenue side. And we've seen some additional spending because schools have had to transition to online learning, and we've had more people using Medicaid, and the unemployment situation means that we have more money coming out of the unemployment fund than we otherwise would. So all of those are some of the impacts that were first line impacts on North Carolina itself, and then you have the later impacts, which is the federal response through the CARES Act and through some other assistance that the federal government has provided financially to the state and to the cities and counties.
So it is an incredible situation, Joe, and every state is facing its challenges. North Carolina, in many ways, is in a better position, and I use the word better in quotes there, considering we're talking about a pandemic, but we're in a better fiscal situation than other states. But you have laid out in Carolina Rebound, again, this new report available at johnlocke.org, some principles for going forward. The tendency by some in a situation like this is to say government must, quote, do something, and that typically means spend more money. That is not your guidance.
No, given that the situation that North Carolina faces is we outline all the revenue that has fallen off. And so the first way to deal with a problem like that is to just stop digging, right? We're in a hole. So the governor's response actually was slower than I would have hoped and would have anticipated, but to cut to freeze hiring and to freeze salaries and to freeze other spending was a good first step. You just don't spend more money than you have to, because there's enough money that you're probably going to have to spend in response. So first thing is, don't spend new money. And then the other thing is, don't raise taxes. Because this is even though it's a revenue shortfall that we're experiencing, the revenue shortfall is because people aren't earning money and can't spend money. And so why would you raise taxes on people who are already in a bad position? And so those are the first two grounding principles, is don't raise taxes and don't spend new money, and look for ways, and following on that is look for ways to cut spending outside of the places that are essential for dealing with the response.
What about that, Joe? I mean, let's say that policymakers say, okay, we think that Joe Coletti and the Locke Foundation are correct on that. So if we can't raise taxes and try to get ourselves some more revenue, where should they start looking then to start trimming that budget?
Yeah, the place to look is, one thing is that we're putting together is looking at what has been added in the last few years of recurring spending. So let's take a look at the programs that are recent additions to the budget, because if North Carolina had been able to function for over 200 years without that program, I'm not sure how essential that is. And some of those are good spending. They have positive impacts, but let's take a look at those new programs that have been added in, say, the last 10 years.
Because we're now in a different context,
right?
So priorities change.
Yeah, yeah. Things that made sense even a year ago might not make sense anymore. Fortunately, again, one of those fortunate in quotes things is that the budget that the legislature passed last year was vetoed by the governor, and so that freed up some money to be able to cover over some holes to get through this year. We have a savings reserve that's over $1 billion, and so that will help with next year. And so the finances may be okay to be able to get through some of these things, but on the cut side, but some of that unspent money is programs that were not implemented, and so before going ahead with some of those planned spending increases, the other thing that the legislature needs to take a look at is all those things that we were going to spend money on that the Senate has said we're not going to even try to pass the budget that the House overrode the governor's veto on. But what are those things that we really just should say, no, we're not going to go forward with that, even though we thought, as we were, 2 weeks before all of this started, that was a great idea. So what are those things that you can start cutting back on? And capital is a clear one, but there are some operating expenses that can probably be foregone.
Joe, in Carolina Rebound, you also take a look at the pressures on local government, yeah, and you have some advice for cities and counties. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So just as with the state government, the first thing to do is cut back on spending and look for places to trim. But at the state level, we also said, let's get a constitutional amendment to reduce future spending, to keep future spending low and keep future taxes low, so that we don't end up in a similar situation when the next recession or pandemic or whatever else hits. And at the local level, local governments were drawing down their reserves in many places, and were in some cases they were well off with good reserves, in some places they weren't. And so looking for how do you make sure that happens so that that the local governments are even stronger going forward. And that's starting with the reduced spending, but looking at the ways to limit the ability for local governments to tax, especially the sales taxes, which are volatile compared to a property tax, which is pretty consistent all around.
And Joe, lastly, we're getting a lot of federal money,
yeah,
coming into the state, and that's in normal times, mm-hmm, we have a lot of federal money coming into the state. But now with the CARES Act in particular, $2 trillion sent out to states, including North Carolina, and that's a lot of decisions to make.
Okay.
We know that they need flexibility on that, and the Locke Foundation has been at the forefront of sounding the alarm, saying, look, a lot of this money, right now, as the law is written, as the CARES Act is written, it has to be spent on new spending.
Right.
And you've written a lot about this. We know that people are trying to get the flexibility to essentially backfill.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to happen?
That's a good question. I'm thinking that some of it will. And the question is, our hope is that the backfill does not come with billions and trillions of dollars of new federal money.
Joe Coletti is senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. Joe, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The COVID-19 pandemic has forced business owners and entrepreneurs across North Carolina to think on their feet. How can they adapt their businesses to new circumstances? One of those business owners is Ron Joyce. He's president and CEO of Triad-based Joyce Farms. He recently took part in an online forum for the John Locke Foundation.
We, in partnership with a lot of small farmers, grow and produce beef, poultry, and pork, mostly primarily heritage breeds. So they're very unique animals that are designed to go primarily to chefs and fine dining restaurants. We have distribution from New England to Florida and then down in the islands in the Caribbean, as far west as probably St. Louis. And we've had things happen like Katrina wiped out one of our big markets for a while when it hit New Orleans. But that was one city, one area. What we saw within about a 36-hour period of time, the week of March 6th or 7th, is our business ground to a halt. 96% of our customers basically were shut down. So, you know, we have obligations with animals. We have obligation to farmers, with employees that we didn't take lightly. So we started looking for other opportunities. In discussing this with one of our distributors, a large distributor we have in the Northeast, they also were selling primarily to restaurants and a lot of chef-owned restaurants. So it was, you know, it had shut them down too. So we started talking with them about changing our processing to producing retail packages, smaller packages that were suitable for retail purchase of the same great meats that we have been producing for chefs. And within a 2-week period of time, they changed their business model from a wholesale delivery company to restaurants to home delivery in New York City and the surrounding areas. They then expanded it to Boston and down to Washington, D.C. And so it's been 6 or 7 weeks. Their volume with us is up almost to the same levels it was before the virus hit, which has been amazing on their part. It's been an amazing partnership with us. I wish I had more distributors that were there, that entrepreneurial and innovative, but our web business has gone through the roof. People are looking for products online.
Ron Joyce explains how COVID-19 has affected customers' preferences.
It seems that people are more interested in where the product comes from now, where their meat's grown, how it's processed. We have a wealth of information. What we do is completely different than the big ag model that we're all used to in this country. We also started, because we had now consumer-sized packages, selling direct to the consumer from our plants. allowing people to schedule appointments and pick product up from our operations.
Joyce explains his company's newest adaptation to COVID-19.
We've just launched a program that we have a few of our chefs using, and we're calling it Chef's Market. A lot of these restaurants have reopened doing pickup or takeout only, but that's severely cut into their revenue. So now that we have these nice retail size packages of amazing products, the chefs have started selling those retail packages to their customers. And so when you come in and pick up a meal to go home, they can offer you product to go home to your freezer, put in your freezer and cook later at another time. So that's another business model we'd never considered before, but we're looking at everything every day. And what that last model does, and with everything we've done, it really keeps our farmers going. It keeps us as a company going. It keeps our employees employed. But now with this new chef's market, it's helping our chef customers maintain some revenue and increase some revenue, because I can do everything that I can think of to try to keep our company in business until this is over. But if my customers don't survive, then I really don't have a business to save.
That's Ron Joyce, president and CEO of Joyce Farms, located in North Carolina's Triad. Joyce emphasizes the role stress plays in the COVID-19 pandemic.
This situation, whether we're navigating through it or not, is extremely stressful. We've had to do things in our plant where we stagger breaks, we stagger lunchtime, we put fewer people in the plant, we're providing PPE. We're doing everything we can, and we're doing that because in order to keep our business going, we've got to keep our employees healthy. That's our motivation. And people have said, well, I really think what you've done is pretty amazing. And I said, you'd be amazed at how much of a motivator fear can be. When you're looking at losing a business that's now third generation with my sons and at 58 years old, and I've put everything that I have into it, taken a lot of risk, made a lot of sacrifices like most business owners have, and then to have it taken away from you over something that we have absolutely no control over. When people talk about the lockdowns, it may be more of a health challenge in this country than the virus. We all are familiar with the negative aspects of stress, from heart hypertension, strokes, suicide, drug use, alcohol use, drug and alcohol abuse. I mean, I think the health aspects of being shut down are going to be far worse than the flu.
Joyce explains how his business and others can be affected by different kinds of government leaders.
We really have two kinds of leaders in this country, whether you're talking about at the national level or the state level or mayors. We have leaders that think that they need to make all the decisions for their constituents, that the constituents aren't smart enough to make their own decisions and be held accountable for those decisions, and that it's their role to dictate to them what they do, where they do it, when they do it, even what size soda they're allowed to drink. And we've seen that in the past. Unfortunately, and I guess this has been the result of the New Deal and the Great Society and some of the programs that have been put in place, we have people, and more, I guess, than I ever realized, who feel that they want this control. They want to be told. I guess they aren't confident that they know what's best for themselves or their family, so they need the government to tell them where they need to live, when they need to work, where they need to work, what they need to do. And unfortunately, we've got more and more people who fall in that category. On the other hand, there are leaders who give us the credit of having enough common sense to know what's good for us, what's good for our families, what's good for our businesses, and how to succeed. And we also, the people that would like that, to be given the opportunity to open up, he's more than willing to take the responsibility of making sure he has a safe and clean environment for his members. And why wouldn't he be? I mean, you know, it could be devastating to his business if he didn't. So there are those of us still left, thank God, that will take that responsibility. We want to make our own decisions. I've had politicians over the years ask me, Ron, what can we do to help you in your business? And I said, quite honestly, stay out of my way. I'll take care of my business. I'll grow my business. I'll take the opportunities. I'll take the risk. But stop putting obstacles in front of us.
That's Ron Joyce, president and CEO of Joyce Farms. He's discussing business challenges linked to the COVID-19 pandemic. Joyce recently took part in an online forum sponsored by the John Locke Foundation. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Among the major subplots of the COVID-19 pandemic story is the search for a vaccine. North Carolina Senator Richard Burr focused on that issue during a recent hearing on Capitol Hill. Burr questioned Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases.
Has anybody in this administration ever asked you or any member to take the foot off the gas of trying to find a cure or any type of countermeasure?
No, Senator, not at all. As a matter of fact, we at NIH, as you know, have been right from the very beginning, put our foot right on that accelerator in every aspect, including the development of vaccines and therapeutics. We actually started that in January, literally days after the virus was known and its sequence was published. So no, I have never been told by anyone to pull back on the development of any countermeasure or any basic and clinical research project that we've been involved in.
North Carolina's senior U.S. senator had a follow-up question for one of the most visible players in the national discussion of COVID-19.
This is one of the fastest development timelines we've ever seen for vaccines. and the American people, and hopefully people around the world will be the beneficiary of what you find and the eventual licensure of that product. What are the biggest unknowns with this particular virus that can affect the development process?
Well, there are a couple of things that I think are inherent in all vaccine development. First of all, there's no guarantee that the vaccine is actually going to be effective. As you well know, because we've discussed this many times in the past, that you can have everything you think that's in place and you don't induce the kind of immune response that turns out to be protective and durably protective. So one, the big unknown is it will be effective. Given the way the body responds to viruses of this type, I'm cautiously optimistic that we will, with one of the candidates, get an efficacy signal. The other thing that's an unknown that's of concern, but we'll be able to get around that by doing the tests properly, is that do you get an enhancement effect? Namely, there have been a number of vaccines, two in particular, when the vaccine induces a suboptimal response, and when a person gets exposed, they actually have an enhanced pathogenesis of the disease, which is always worrisome. So we want to make sure that that doesn't happen. Those are the two major unknowns. Putting all those things together, Senator Burr, I still feel cautiously optimistic that we will have a candidate that will give some degree of efficacy, hopefully a percentage enough that will induce the kind of herd immunity that would give a protection to the population at home.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He's answering questions from North Carolina Senator Richard Burr. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina state government has one of the nation's best funded pension plans, so there's no reason to worry about it, right? Well, our next guests suggest there is need for some concern, and they say now is a good time for needed reforms. Leonard Gilroy is Vice President for Government Reform at the Libertarian Reason Foundation. He is Senior Managing Director of Reason's Pension Integrity Project. Jen Sidorova is a Policy Analyst for Reason's Pension Integrity Project. They just worked on a recent study of the North Carolina Pension Plan for Reason and the John Locke Foundation. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate being here.
Good to be here.
So this is the state pension plan that deals with retired government workers, teachers, and for years we've heard, hey, this is in good shape. The funding has been almost 100%, or at least more than 90% for years and years. You looked at this plan, though, and said, you know, the news is not all roses. There's some reason for concern. How so?
Well, thanks for the question. The work that we've done is looking at the teachers and state employees retirement system here in North Carolina, which has been historically regarded as and has been a well-funded plan relative to other public pension plans nationally. What we see, though, today is a situation in which that plan, which has been historically healthy, today, after arguably 10 years at the top of a bull run in the market, et cetera, is sitting at 86% funded today, when we would rather see pension plans after a decade of markets climbing and moving off the recession be closer to 100% funded. And so we got in and dug in and analyzed what's happening there and what factors are at play and make some recommendations about how to take what is, structurally a pretty well designed plan and make some tweaks to orient it for the future.
And Jed, I imagine that you did a lot of the legwork on this. As you looked at it, what did you see as some of the things that stood out?
So we did some stress testing, and we put the plan, we put their financials into a position when, so let's look at what happens if the plan underperforms, what if the interest rate is not going to be as high as the plan leadership thinks, or what's going to happen if we hit the next recession. And that's a question I'm pretty sure is, you know, in everyone's heads right now. So so in both scenarios, if the plan underperforms only by 1%, it can accumulate up to $16 billion in liabilities over the next 30 years. And right now it's, the unfunded liabilities right now are about $11 billion. So it's more than doubles. If the plan underperforms only by 1%, which you wouldn't seem like all that much, but it ends up being, you know, a lot, at the end of the day. And the same, practically the same fiscal impact is brought up by, you know, a possible recession. So we kind of looked at what's going to happen if the, the returns that we had in the last recession are going to happen in the next couple of years. And we saw that, you know, the fiscal impact is going to be pretty much the same as, you know, as more than doubling of unfunded liabilities. And we also looked at other things like how the funded ratio would perform. And we see that there is a lot of uncertainty brought up by, you know, stress from outside.
So basically, it sounds as if both of you and your co-workers on this, along with John Locke Foundation and Joe Coletti, said, you know, the good times are not going to last forever. We know we're going to take some kind of hit. How will this pension plan stack up when the next bad time hits? Is that right?
No, that's right. I mean, and that's what policymakers across the country should be asking today, given that we've got over $1.3 trillion of unfunded public pension liabilities at the state and local level across the country. Again, after 10 years of being at the top of a market, you could argue a historic run. And we have plans that are still sitting in the, you know, 70 to 80% funded range on average. That suggests that there are factors at play beyond even just markets that we really need to be attuned to. The good news, I guess, for North Carolina would be that a lot of the design features and sort of pension plan elements that other states get wrong, that have led to the $1.3 plus trillion of unfunded liabilities nationally, North Carolina in this TSERS plan, the Teachers and State Employees plan, doesn't do a lot of those things. Some of the it's got some very good design features built in, and I think that's what's notable is that, despite having lots of good design features built in to pay off your unfunded liabilities faster, to be more conservative than other pension plans, that sort of thing nationally, still, despite that, you can have just a couple of things that if they go wrong, as my colleague Jen was just saying, if you are just instead of getting a 7% investment return, which the plan is expecting, it's if you get just 6, which is not a crazy number. I think in our own personal investment histories, and I think what we see out there, institutions getting this is not an unrealistic or meant to create fear. This is what if something normal happens, and you know, as our numbers would suggest, you could more than double your current unfunded liabilities over the next couple of decades. That still, even with mechanisms built to keep it resilient, you have some factors that can still come into play. And so we think that this now is the time before the next recession hits and before every agency is coming to the state appropriators asking for more money, that you should take care of first things first. And this would be one of those elements in terms of fiscal priorities of the state, taking care of the promises made to retired teachers and public workers, I would say is up there in terms of the priority list.
We are speaking with Leonard Gilroy and Jen Sidorova with the Reason Foundation and its Pension Integrity Project. You've alluded to them already, but what are some of the things North Carolina should do now while it has the opportunity?
Well, the first thing that stood out when we looked at what brought us to this moment when we had all those unfunded liabilities was the unrealized investment return. And investment return is something that it's the return that we expect from our portfolio of assets. And if you look at the dynamic over the past 17 years, the average return was about 6.3%. And the plan is currently at 7% expected return. So that's, you know, it's been underperforming. And if you look at the turn of the century when a lot of most of the plans were fully funded and North Carolina was actually at 110% funded, now it's only about 86.7% funded. So it's, you know, if you look at the big picture, at the dynamic throughout the years, it's been trending downward. So it's quite a significant dip that it made. So another thing that stood out was the interest on debt. And it's another very, taxing, thing on the plan because, that's the most expensive debt you can have. And it's growing at least at the rate of your assumed return, which is 7%. And that's a high rate for your debt to grow at. So I think I would point those two things that, you know, I would prioritize. But as my colleague said, there are a lot of things that North Carolina does correctly. And we pointed out in our report as well, because it has been lowering the assumed rate of return. And it's putting their unfunded liabilities on a short 12-year amortization schedule. And that's much better than a lot of the plans. But at the same time, you got to be mindful that you got to keep improving your funding policy, like maybe making those small changes here and now so that you don't have to deal with the crisis situation in a couple of years. You know,
pay me now or pay me much more later.
That's exactly right.
That is Leonard Gilroy. You also heard from his colleague, Jen Sidorova. They are with the Reason Foundation and its Pension Integrity Project. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. As North Carolina begins to emerge from the COVID-19 statewide shutdown order imposed by Governor Roy Cooper, the challenges we face are enormous, yet so are the opportunities. COVID-19 has illustrated the great promise of healthcare innovations and free markets to expand access to care and to help lower costs. A way forward with healthcare opportunities is laid out in Carolina Rebound. That is the John Locke Foundation's new game plan for reviving our economy. The healthcare policy analyst who authored part of this new report is here with his recommendations. He is Jordan Roberts. Jordan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Set the stage for us, if you would. How has COVID-19 really impacted healthcare in North Carolina?
Sure. So I think the biggest thing to point out is that, you know, as we saw the early spread of the disease, a lot of the major hospitals and providers, they completely shifted focus. They stopped doing elective procedures. They stopped, you know, doing some of the normal patient procedures that they were doing and switched all their focus to COVID treatment. And that included stocking up on supplies, you know, clearing out whole wings to treat COVID patients. And, you know, that completely changes the whole business model of these providers. They were not getting the income from the elective procedures. procedures, and they are, we're kind of in a wait and see period to see how, what the influx of COVID patients would be. So a lot of the providers, their entire business plan for this year was interrupted. I think another thing is we've seen just tragic job loss around the entire country, but North Carolina is not immune to that. And so, you know, with the odd arrangement we have in this country where most people get their health insurance from work, when you lose your job, you may lose your health insurance. We've seen, you know, upwards of a million people unemployed here in North Carolina. Presumably, a lot of them have lost their health insurance. So that affects families and how they pay for health insurance and things like that. And then, you know, the other thing we've seen is a lot of longstanding healthcare policies that have governed the practice of medicine have been either changed or waived. And so some things that, you know, used to be illegal in the state are now legal. And so we're seeing a changing landscape with the regulatory framework as well.
A big impact, in other words, on healthcare in North Carolina. You mentioned the unemployment situation, and it's huge, unfortunately. Oddly enough, at the very time when healthcare workers are on the front lines dealing with COVID-19, there are a lot of healthcare workers that themselves have lost their jobs, and people don't realize that. And it gets us to this question of access to care and medical professionals. First of all, why are healthcare workers being laid off when they're in demand?
Right.
And then how do we make sure that we have access to a larger pool?
Yeah, so it's a peculiar situation as we, you know, reserved all these healthcare workers to treat the influx of COVID patients. You know, many of the facilities that employed them could not afford to pay them anymore without the elective procedures. So as we need more frontline healthcare workers, some of them had to be laid off because of the financial situation. So that's something we're dealing with. But, you know, in North Carolina, we have one of the most rural populations, a lot of medical deserts, a lot of medically underserved places. And so, you know, we say that this is a maldistribution of providers. We have enough providers in the state. They're just not distributed in an appropriate way to meet the needs of all these communities. And so that's why, you know, a lot of the recommendations in this piece are about increasing access to medical providers, increasing the amount of supply, because one thing we haven't had is an adequate supply around the state. This includes things like opening up licensure restrictions to allow out of medical providers who hold a license from another state to come into North Carolina and practice, to increase the scope of practice for current providers in the state to allow them to do more for patients. And, you know, things like telemedicine and telehealth allow, same thing as licensing, allow professionals in other states that are in good standing with their medical boards to treat patients in North Carolina. Because right now we actually just restrict access to all of these professionals.
Let's talk about telehealth and telemedicine first, because so many people have been mandated by government in our state, Governor Roy Cooper's statewide shutdown order, to stay home.
Mm-hmm.
Jobs eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
But yet people still need access to health care, whether it's related to COVID-19 or not. And so we've seen more people introduced to the idea of communicating with a doctor or a nurse or a pharmacist over their smartphone or their laptop. So oddly enough, it took a pandemic to get more people to realize it is possible to receive quality care this way.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this was already on the rise, but now this pandemic has shown that, you know, a lot of care that we traditionally, you know, go to a brick and mortar doctor's office for, a lot of it can be done over virtual means, such as telehealth video conferencing. But, you know, the one thing I want to point out is that even though as we move forward into a more probably digital health oriented world, there are still a lot of state and federal laws that restrict, you know, the types of devices one can use, where one must be to receive telehealth the insurer pay for it. So there's all these different things to restrict it. And so, you know, one of the recommendations in the paper is just to open up, have a very flexible regulatory framework so there's not any new technology that's restricted from being used, or a doctor may want to try something that's illegal in North Carolina, things like that.
And Jordan, too, it seems kind of crazy that we're living in a world that is completely interconnected. You can have a conversation with someone who is literally around the world from you. And yet, if you're trying to access medical care, there's a real impediment to trying to access someone who isn't physically within the confines of the state of North Carolina. That seems such old thinking.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this is what I point out in the Carolina Rebound recommendations, is that so much of healthcare regulations is sort of this old guard mentality that, you know, just entrenched interest protecting their turf. And, you know, that's what I really call for, is that, you know, we need to break up these old restrictionist and protectionist policies that have governed the practice of healthcare for so long, because all they do is, you know, limit the amount of supply, limit what doctors can do, and limit how patients can access care. And, you know, with something like medicine and medical care, something so personal to the individual and personal decisions being made between a doctor and a patient, you know, the government should get out of the way and not try to make these decisions for medical providers and patients. And so, you know, all of the recommendations in my section of the Carolina Rebound call for the unwinding of some of these, you know, protectionist policies that have not achieved their goals. And we have 40 or 50 years of evidence of that.
You also point out that some medical professionals are impeded from really providing the full access of their knowledge. Mm-hmm. You single out nurse practitioners and also pharmacists. Mm-hmm. Tell us about what they could be doing that right now they can't.
Yeah. So nurse practitioners are, you know, practice a lot of in primary care settings. And so they, in order to practice in North Carolina, they have to go into a collaborative practice agreement with a physician. And so their practice is limited to what their physician allows them to do, and to what if they have a supervising physician on hand. And so what we want to see is that collaborative practice agreement eliminated, so that nurse practitioners can practice however they see fit and wherever they see fit, to help with that maldistribution of supply or of providers. And then on the pharmacist side, what we've seen in other states is that some states are allowing pharmacists to take up a few more testing and treatment of non-chronic diseases. So what this does is it utilizes the healthcare infrastructure that we have, and it allows primary care doctors to focus more on some of the big, you know, more complicated procedures.
Jordan Roberts is healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. Thank you, Jordan.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.